Blog Talk Radio.
I'm looking for a reason, roaming through the night to find my place in this world, my place in this world.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in internet land. I hope your halls were decked and your bells jingled and you got what you needed and all your sweaters fit and whatever else, whatever other good thing could happen out of the Christmas holiday. I pray that it happened to you. If you're not listening live and you're listening out of the archives, this is the Monday after Christmas, and I've had a surprise this morning. Look out my window, and there are some roofers. We had a roof put on 6 months ago, and now they came to replace the gutters. I didn't think December 28th would be a work day for when it just snowed over the weekend, but hey, there looks like they're done with my house, and they're moving on to the next one. So they got to work, and I'm working, and I trust whatever you're doing, you are doing what you enjoy, and that there's a lot of family time mixed in as well. Have just an exciting show today. I'll be bringing my guest on in a few minutes, a brother, a friend, a colleague, and someone I met 30 years ago, and we'll talk about the setting where I met him, and we'll even more importantly talk about how God is using him today. And that is my brother and friend Jim Atkins from way down in warm, sunny Florida. We'll be bringing him on in just a moment. My wife and I went off to Virginia for the weekend. We felt safe doing so. We have not been any place. Our family had not been any place for weeks, and except to the store. So I say if I run into the store to get a package of meat and I get the virus, then there was nothing I could do. And so, but anyway, we had a great weekend and nice traveling. We stopped in to deliver groceries to my 94-year-old mother-in-law and stopped by my sister-in-law's house. We met out on the back porch and talked for about 30 minutes with masks on, and then went to our families. So, you know, I'm not getting into the arguments or the debates of the mask or no mask. I'm just as happy to wear one. You know, it doesn't bother me to do that, but it doesn't bother me if somebody doesn't want to do it. I do. I'm not sure I understand why they wouldn't, but I respect some of the reasoning behind it. I don't think it's cavalier. And anyway, I don't even want to get into it here because I can already hear people clicking or people sending me an email, and that's not the purpose of this show. It is about purpose and helping you find purpose and fulfill purpose, and you're going to hear a purpose-laden story today, one of the more exciting ones that you will hear. I was just talking on my Facebook Live before we bring our guest on, and I really had an interesting revelation a couple of weeks ago, maybe not even that long ago. There's been a ministry I've been out of quite a while, and just, you know, feeling like I didn't hit the mark, and gave what I thought were some pretty good suggestions for some problems that they had. And I felt the Lord speak to me and say, I removed you from that situation because I didn't want them hearing any more truth of what you had to say that they weren't capable of doing, but they would then be responsible for. And as I explained on Facebook Live, I did not receive that as, oh, I was superior spiritually to them. How I took it, or how I've applied it, is, God, where have you had to do that in my life? Where have you had to limit your input or wisdom or revelation to me because I wasn't ready for it? Now, you know, there's some things my 14-year-old, if I had a 14-year-old, just is not ready for because he's not mature enough. or she's not mature enough. She has to develop more in her thought process, or he has to develop more physically. So there is an aspect of growth and maturity in the Lord that God can't share some things with us because just where we are at in our walk, we can't handle it. But what really impacted me is, God, I don't want that to happen because of my own irresponsibility, of my own inability to open myself for you to develop me and grow me so that I can hear more and do more. And you know my mantra of the last year, put me in, coach, the even title of one of my books. But, you know, there are players that say, put me in, coach, and the coach can't put them in because they think they're ready for a certain game situation, but they're not. And then they can blame the coach, and I'm not getting played. But the issue is that sometimes they're just not capable of taking on that responsibility. So my point in all that is, God, my prayer is, God, help me increase my capacity, increase my ability to receive from you, and not just to receive, but to grow from it and to communicate it and be able to share it with other people. I don't want to, you know, Hebrews, where it talks about you should have moved on to deeper things, to things that are beyond the basic elements of the foundation. God, I want to move on. Now, that's my desire, but I think I'm still going to have a capacity. I'm going to have whatever the level of gift that God gave me, I can't go beyond what that level would be. But I want to maximize it. I want to get to the highest level that I can. Anyway, enough about that. Let's bring our guest on for today, my good friend and brother, Jim Adkins. Jim, welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
Well, thank you, sir, and I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, it's good to chat with you. It's been a few years. One of the delights of the last 9 months, if I can use that word, because there hadn't been a lot of positive news out there, but I have reconnected with so many dear friends and brothers and sisters, and you are certainly one of them near the top of the list, so it is great to be reconnected with your life, and trust that you had a Merry Christmas.
We had a great Christmas. I guess we're just like everybody else. This whole coronavirus thing has limited, you know, our ability to travel and see our family right, like we had in the past. But we did get to see my daughter, who's over in the Daytona Beach area, and all my grandkids. I'm a grandfather now, five times over, as a matter of fact.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I have a son that's here locally in what we call Orlampa area, which is anywhere in between Tampa and Orlando, that
right
area. So that's how we spent Christmas. But we, you know, we had each other, and we decorated the house, and we did it like we always do, and it was a great time.
Yeah, yeah. Tell our listeners a little bit about what your ministry involvement is right now. What are you doing? Where are you doing? What does it entail? Just take all the time you want to kind of give us an overview.
Well, currently, the last 4 years I've spent as my title is facility coordinator for the one and only, actually, drug rehab in our area. It's a residential men's program, 35-bed capacity. A little different from what I have been doing in the past. I've worked a lot of different jobs, but at the same time, while I was working those jobs, we held a little small 5-bed transitional home. But this is a completely different ball game here with these guys. Same principles apply. We've had the opportunity to, I've been teaching life skills and pre-employment skills, and I teach criminal thinking to these guys, which if there's one subject I know, it's that one. So that's what the last 4 years have been. And that takes up a tremendous amount of our time because it's, you know, basically on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I've loved it. It's been the best job of my life. I've had some
really
great jobs. worked for some great companies, made good money, had nice things, but I love this job. I love what I do, love the opportunity. It hasn't even been a job. I mean, I'd rather, I can't think of where I'd rather be most times besides home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What makes it what makes it so special?
Because I guess I just feel so at home with these guys. I feel like I'm able to maximize everything God's put in my life over all these years. He's just been building this thing up in me for years and years and years, training me. My life experience has been better than any college course I could have taken. I don't know where you would get that kind of education or training. Just working with these guys in various levels. And I mean, any job I've ever had, I've always tried to help guys get jobs. And when, like I said, this transition house that we've had has always been about teaching guys and training guys and helping them move ahead with their life and look at some of these, look at some of the perspectives that they have that have been causing them problems. So when I got the opportunity to do that full time and get paid for it, I mean, it's just, it was a dream come true, to be honest with you.
Yeah. What share with us a little bit. What's, you know, you said it's a 24-hour, you know, kind of on call, but what's a typical day, or if you can't describe a day, what's a typical week look like for you now?
Well, the reason I say it's 24/7 is because my particular role, they call me facility coordinator, which basically means I make sure that everything runs smoothly. So I'm not clinical. I don't do any of the, I don't set up any of the programming directives necessarily. Like I said, I teach some classes, and they've given me a lot of opportunity to, you know, a lot of room to do that on my own. But because I'm there to make sure everything runs smoothly and there's no issues, I handle a group of guys called the human services technicians, which are the guys who kind of police the area and make sure that things run smoothly and there's no problems, logistics and that sort of thing. It's just not one of those jobs where you walk away from at the end of the day.
Uh-huh.
There's always something brewing. There's always something going on. When you put 30 guys in a facility who have had backgrounds of criminality and drugs and dysfunction and lack of parenting or poor parenting or zero parenting, it's just an ongoing. You're just almost waiting for the next issue. And so I just made myself available. You call me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's not unusual to get those calls because crisis doesn't have a, you know, it happens when it happens.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was just going to say, so I get there at the, you know, wee hours of the morning, 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock, depending on what the deal is. And if I can get out of there by 5 o'clock, that's a good day. Sometimes I stay a little later. And sometimes I no sooner get home than they're calling me and saying, I'm having a problem with this or that or this guy or that guy. Sometimes it requires me coming back into the facility and dealing with it or getting the guys on the phone or, you know, so it's just, but I love it.
How do the guys get there, and how long would they typically be there? I mean, how are they released? Where are they released to? Give us a little bit about their journey.
So it's an 8 to 10 month long program. You say 8 to 10 months because it kind of depends on how you phase and how you carry yourself. You can leave as early as 8 months, or you can, you know, find yourself there till 10 months. Most of our guys, and I say most of them, come through the court system. We deal directly with the county jail. It's another aspect of my job is to go down and talk to guys in the county jail who want to come to our program, or their parents call us, or their wife calls us and says he's down in jail. We vet them. We work with the state attorneys and the judges and the drug courts and that sort of thing. So an 8 to 10 month program. We do have some guys that walk in. It's kind of rare, but it happens.
And so who determines when they're released and what determines their eligibility to be released?
Right. So it's what we call a four-phase program to meet certain requirements. in each of those phases to reach the next phase. We call it leveling up. So there's a what we call a multidisciplinary team that meets every Thursday. And that's comprised of course, the clinical counselors, our director, representatives from the probation office, from mental health, and various other organizations that work with us. So every Thursday we all get together, we go through the whole roster of guys and determine how they're doing, where they're at. It also gives them an opportunity when they reach that certain level up stage, they have to come back and present, we call it, to the disciplinary team. And by presenting, they're asked a series of questions, they're tested to see if they've reached that level of phase. We talk about their disciplinary issues or lack of, or whatever the situation is, mental health, whatever the deal is. And then the panel votes. We let them leave the room. We all vote on whether or not they're ready to phase up, bring them back in, congratulate them, or tell them we're going to need another week or whatever the situation is. It's also a time for us to deal with disciplinary issues. If you got in trouble during the week for this infraction or the other, then you come in on that Thursday during the disciplinary team meeting and, you know, you're asked to address those things.
Is this a faith-based program?
It is not, sir. No. It's not anti-faith-based, but it's just not built on that. It's a county program called Tri-County.
Gotcha. Go ahead. Keep finishing.
So anyway, the program phases in such a way that it's transitional in that after for example, their first 60 days, they have no outside contact, no phones, no visits, no, you can't leave the facility, you can't see your parents, you can't see your children. That's so that we can get their attention to start with, take away all the distractions because those things are so distracting. What's going on with the family? They just have to, you know, there's nothing they can do about it while they're in our program anyway, to start with, especially at that level. You're not prepared to deal with it. You're not in any position to deal with it. You don't have the resources to deal with it. So it's better that it's just left alone for 60 days. We explain all this to the families. We talk to them, so they're prepared for that. So after that 60 days, then we start implementing, you know, the opportunities to use their phone for a certain amount of time, or they might get a visit. Eventually, by the time they get to the fourth stage, last stage of our program, they're working full time. That's another one of our aspects. I also work as job developer. I've worked with several of the employers here in the county who have agreed to give our guys a shot based on the fact that we make sure that they're there every single day. We make sure they're sober. We make sure if there's any issues, they can pick the phone up. And it's been really successful. All of our guys do well. All of our guys leave our facility with a full-time job. Some of them making more money than I do, which is the truth. And, but it's a great thing. And we've just watched, I mean, not in every case. We're not any different than any other rehab, faith-based or otherwise, that, you know, some guys, like you were saying in your opening monologue, that there's just a time. Sometimes they're just not ready for all that yet, regardless of what we've done for them. One of the things I talk about, Dr. John, is that verse in the Bible that we use so often when we're talking about raising our children. We say, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from us. Not to reinterpret that verse, but just to get a different application, I think, is that there are people that we meet, like some of these guys I have at my facility, who emotionally and spiritually are still children. They just haven't been raised in those kind of things. And we understand that if we teach them those things, it may not immediately have an effect, but as they grow and as they mature and they grow into it, I believe God comes back and takes those things and gives them the opportunity to walk in some of it.
Yeah, you certainly sound purposeful and happy. You made a statement, Jim, earlier on that you teach you do some training on criminal thinking, and you said you would, of anybody, would understand that. What did you mean by that?
Well, I was thinking back of when we met 30 years ago, because I was thinking this question might come up, was where we met. And as I recall, I was living in a large gated community in Daytona Beach, which I thought sounded better than saying that you and I met in prison, because I didn't know how your listeners would take that.
Certainly. Oh, no, they'll be fine.
We had a different status when we met in prison.
Yeah. We did. Our friend Jim Newsom. Jim used to say, I grew up listening to the radio, but he grew up stealing them. But God brought us together, and we made a great team. Much later in life.
Yeah.
So, but talk to us about when we met.
Would it be all right if I went back like a year before we met?
Oh, please. Do you just take your liberties?
And the reason I say that is because, John, I feel like that, for me anyway, I'll just say for me, the way I see God work most times is in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always see his hand moving at the time that it's moving.
Right.
And so for me, it's like it's like those big domino displays that people set up, and you're on one end and God's on the other, and he topples the first piece. Well, you just don't see that coming, I mean, until it's on top of you sometimes. Or even in hindsight, you realize he was moving all along. And I just find it interesting when I think back about our lives, and me and you, I mean, that you were in transition as well. I mean, you were a Pennsylvania, an accountant, and in ministry, and doing those kind of things. I know you didn't see yourself in a prison at that point. You didn't see that coming necessarily.
Right.
Any more than while I was sitting in prison thinking I was going to spend the rest of my life there. At the time that you and I met, I had a piece of paper literally in my, and this was in 1990, I guess, somewhere in that area, 91. I had a piece of paper in my locker that said I wasn't getting out of prison until 2011. That was a long time. I'd been sentenced to 22 years, and it wasn't my first time going to prison. It was actually my fourth time. So a year or so before we met, I was so sick of my life, just so sick of it. I'd only been out of prison 6 months and got arrested again in a whole string of things, theft-related garbage. And I, in that little county jail up in Panama City, I was just so sick of my life, and I said, listen, God, this was my sinner's prayer. I said, God, I don't even know if you exist or not. I'm not positive. But if you do, either take my life or change my life. And I mean, that was sincere. That was from the heart. That's not some sappy story. I'm telling you, that's where I was at in my life. I didn't want to live another day as that guy. And God was faithful. I mean, he honored that completely. I didn't realize at the time there was those dominoes. Immediately he said, fine, I've been waiting on that. And I was sentenced to prison. He didn't get me out of that. He didn't change any of that. I went to prison 22 years. That was forever to me. I was only 30 years old. But I never dreamed in a million years that it would be by going to that chapel service and the two guys walking in that day, you and Brother Jim, coming in and starting a little discipleship class, how that would impact our lives. And I say ours, because there was a group of guys, and I stayed in touch with some of them over the years, and I know for a fact that even to this day, we talk about how impactful that was in our lives at the time. We couldn't wait for you guys to come back the next week. I know you probably didn't realize that at the time. I don't know how you feel about how that time was spent while you were down there, but I'm telling you, it changed lives. And I'm one of them, for sure.
My memory, Jim, is it was a special. I looked forward to every Wednesday. We would come up, we would do the class, then we would go out and have dinner, and we would come back and do an evening service. And it was never grievous. It was because God met us there every time.
Yes, sir.
There was never. I mean, it was it was like Jesus was waiting there for us to, it's not like we got together and he came, it's he came waiting for us. And when we got there, there was revelation, there was freedom, there was worship, there was joy, there was insight. I remember after we I taught the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, you guys wrote a similar program for 7 Habits of Highly Effective Inmates. Do you remember that?
I do. Yes, yeah. Sir. That was your assignment to us every time that we should do
mm-hmm.
that. And that went on.
Yeah.
You know, one of the guys who stayed in prison long after I left, Mike Powers. I know you still remember him. Mike stayed in there for, oh goodness, Mike just got out after doing 41 years. And he loves Jesus, and he's serving the Lord, and he's doing well, has been. That was a turning point for Mike as well. But Mike went on, and he wrote his own little Bible study. He would teach it out there on the compound. And even after you guys had moved on and I had moved on, they actually brought Mike in, and he was fulfilling that role. He was actually teaching in the chapel. They were giving him a room and letting him teach those friends and boys.
Wow.
Those were good days.
Yeah, and it was always special. And I remember after I moved back to Mobile, Alabama, and I was working for Integrity Music, I came back several years later, and Chaplain Donaldson was there, and he let me come in, and I really came in to thank all of you for the role that you played in my own development, because you know, when I came to Orlando, I had not done a lot of ministry. What I had done was not really well received by my church. They didn't pay much attention. So when I came and had a group that were really interested and believed what I was saying was what God had shown me, which I know he had shown me about purpose and goal setting and productivity and faith. And so it gave me confidence when I left prison ministry in Florida to go out and teach those things on a broader level. And I thought, who would have thought that God would have used guys in the prison where I was going to release me? And I wasn't just saying that, I meant it. And still would mean it to this day, because it was always special. I did send Mike some books. When I send you the books, I haven't heard from them. I hope they got to the right address. But I'll just tell this story too, that I used to say, you know, I think we should take offerings in prison, and I know we weren't allowed to. And I said, even if somebody gave a cigarette and a pencil, I feel like the guys shouldn't just always be receivers; they should be givers.
Right.
Well, I was getting ready to make my transition out of Florida back to Alabama, and I get a big brown envelope one day, and one of the guys through his family sent me a very generous offering. And I can remember sitting in my desk and crying, and I'm saying, inmates do give offerings. You know, it was so spiritual. It was, and I never asked for anything. No. That was purely something the Spirit would have had that person do through their brother. And but that just indicative to me of how God blessed me day in, day out, every time I went in. And for me, the prison ministry was better than pastoring. When I was in Florida, it was that good.
Yes, sir. And you know, since I've been out, I've had the opportunity to go back into prisons, starting back in early 2000s. I don't remember when. At one point, I was going in there every Sunday, spending all day at the main unit, and then going over to the work ham at the evening times.
Mm-hmm.
3 and 4 services every Sunday for years,
yeah.
Every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always tried to model what you taught us in there. And I mean, your model for ministry was different than many of the ones that came in. And by that, I mean that so many of the ministries that come in are evangelistic to start with.
Right.
So you see them once a week or once a month or 3 or 4 times a year. They hit you with the gospel, they sing, they entertain, they tell you about Jesus, and down the road they go.
Uh-huh.
There's no connection. Uh-huh. And occasionally there's a guy who comes in and wants to teach a Bible study, generally, you know, six or seven people attend or 10 people attend. It can be sometimes sectarian, you know, and just, but yours was a completely different thing. It required something of us, for starters. That was one of the interesting things. First of all, you didn't just let anybody attend the Bible study, the discipleship uh-huh. class. It wasn't a Bible study. It was a discipleship
right,
class.
Right.
You made that distinction. Uh-huh. But we had requirements of our lifestyle and our, you know, we couldn't be involved in criminal activity and canteens. Just the fact that you required uh-huh. something for us, because that was brand new, for starters.
Uh-huh.
And secondly, it was because it was empowering. You didn't just teach us things, give us more information, but you gave us an opportunity to apply those things and encourage that and pushed us back out into the general population with a message and a confidence that we could go out and talk about Jesus and talk about discipleship class, discipleship,
uh-huh.
the practical
yeah.
part of walking for Jesus.
Yeah, and we did do some evangelism. We would have, you know, our mm-hmm. evening services, and we did our weekend the Lion's Den seminar.
Lion's
we
Den.
Would come in, do a weekend session. I wrote my book last year, Success in Babylon. That was the format, the infrastructure for that was what I taught 30 years ago in the Life is the Lion's Den seminars. And again, the presence of God was always there. We went all over the state of Florida to deliver those. They were well received, but Tomoka was always coming home. It was always home base for us because of the receptivity of all of you. The relationship we had with the chaplains, and I mean, we'd check in, they'd frisk us, and then we'd walk down to the chapel by ourselves, no escorts, and no fear on our part. It was great. Well, tell me again, because we connected after you got out. Talk a little bit about the circumstances of you. How long were you in, and what happened? How did God move to get you out?
Okay, so, like I said, we met, I think, in the early 90s. I think maybe 91,
right.
if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right.
Seems right to me, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was doing a 22-year sentence. Four-time loser, they call it. I hate that term, but that's just the term that we mm-hmm. use. Three-time loser, four-time loser. That was me. And I wasn't in the appeals court. I wasn't trying to appeal my case.
Right.
Actually, to be honest with you, I was thankful that I got the time that I got, because at the time they were doing what they call the Habitual Offender Act, and guys were getting
mm-hmm.
30 and 40 and life sentences,
mm-hmm.
and I ducked all of that. I mean, I missed it all. And I'm sure that was God's hand in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So after several years, they sent me over to what they call the work camp. And to finish out, you know, the whatever years, I still had a tremendous amount of time in my book. Was involved in PRIDE, which is a prisoner rehabilitative industry. They teach you various trades.
All right. Uh-huh.
Didn't realize how God was going to use that as well. As I got out, it seemed like just something to do and a way to make a little bit of change. I think they paid me 45 cents an hour to work there, which was, you know, which was great at the time. I took a course while I was in there, got involved in a class over there in upholstery, automotive upholstery. So I learned automotive upholstery. I worked in a factory that built DOT trucks and fire trucks and ambulances, and they remodeled sheriff's substations and mobile substations and blah, blah, blah. Something to do and a way to make a little money. That's the way I looked at it, but just tried to keep myself busy. And Mike was real, Mike was kind of my mentor in there and kind of pushed me forward in some of those things. Go get your GED, go get your, take some vocational classes. Don't just sit around and play games and play cards. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Mike would push me forward, and I took advantage of that. He helped me get through some of those classes and helped me get into some of those opportunities. At some point, I'm working, and they would call the bell in the morning, and they would say, everybody line up for work. You're either going here, going there, going to Pride, going out to work on the side of the road. This particular morning, this was in 1998.
Uh-huh.
They said, Jim, you and me and a handful of other guys, you guys are not going out this morning. We thought was odd. That's usually not a good thing. It usually means they're calling you in for some kind of disciplinary issue or you have to go see somebody. But they called me in and said, somebody in the federal courts won a case, and it involves your case. It has to do with the type of sentencing and the type of the year or the situation. And we have to award X amount of gain time. You're leaving in 90 days. That was the bottom line.
Wow. Wow.
So I went from yesterday morning, I still had seven more years to do. I'm going home in 3 months. But God had been putting all that stuff together. At the time that happened, one of the funny stories about that time was that there was a group of guys when I got to the work camp who said that they were involved in a group called Overcomers Anonymous, Overcomers Outreach, I'm sorry. It was OO.
Mm-hmm.
This was before Celebrate Recovery. This was a faith-based 12-step program, Overcomers Outreach.
Mm-hmm.
And that they had put a little group together, and because my background in the Bible and understand things, would I consider being the chairman of the group and kind of getting it started and getting them going? So I said, sure, I'll go in there and visit with you guys on this Thursday or Friday night, whatever time. Well, I guess Friday nights is when it was. So I went in there on this Friday night to talk to them about this Overcomers Outreach, only to find out that it was really a group of Aryan Brotherhood. There was like eight of them that were really, they were really learning this stuff from the Aryan Brotherhood. It's a very racist, white supremacist type group. And I immediately cut them off and told them, I don't play that game. I'm not part of that. You guys want to do Overcomers Outreach, we'll do that. But this right here is wrong. This is stupid. None of what you're telling me even makes sense. Nothing that you're showing me here is biblical or has any basis. Believe it or not, the Aryan Brotherhood, which is a real powerful white supremacist group in prisons, operates under the shadow of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian out of Hayden Lake, Utah. But they're anything but Christian. These guys are insane.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how God – and listen – I took that group from there. I'm just going to tell you the short story is that we actually started Overcomers Outreach. From that, Dave Moffitt, who was one of the outside volunteers, he and I connected in that arena. And what we decided to do was that we would start bringing local pastors in every other Friday night for the purpose of them being able to connect with these guys inside, so that we would start building community for these guys to have some place to go when they
mm-hmm.
got out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody at the work camp was going home. So these various pastors from various churches would come in on Friday nights, introduce themselves, introduce their church, their ministry, get to know the guys, start building relationships. And it turned into this huge thing where we had 200 people sometimes. They wouldn't let anybody else in the group. The group, depending on who it was that was coming, we were packing the building out. Because it just, God was in that. So as a result of them telling me I had 90 days to go home, thankfully I had made some, built some relationships with some of these people. One of the guys had a transition house. He said, don't worry about it. You come to our transition house. We got a place for you. So I had a place to go. I had somebody who was going to look out for me. I wasn't caught off guard because I'd made some good decisions along the way, to start preparing myself. Even though I didn't realize that I was actually leaving in 90 days when I was doing this, I was just happened that way. When I got out, I started working for a guy who was paying me cash every day, a Christian guy owned a business. He paid me cash every day to shovel asphalt in the middle of the summer in Daytona Beach, which almost killed me.
Mm-hmm.
But someone that I was with said, don't you do that upholstery thing? There's a big boat company called Sea Ray that's hiring, and they're hiring upholsterers. That's one of the things I saw on the page, and I thought, That's Brunswick Corporation, which is a huge multi-billion dollar corporation, bowling alleys and bowling balls, and, you know, Mercury Motors and Remington shotguns and life exercise equipment. I said, they're not going to hire somebody with 22 felony convictions. That's ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky to have the job I have. That's how I felt about it. But the guy said, what do you got to lose, Jim? You know what I mean? What's the worst thing to do? Tell you no. I went down there and filled out the application. And while I was filling out the application, I realized that what we called that question wasn't on there. I kept flipping the thing over and over again looking for that question, which is, you know, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And could you please list them? It just wasn't even on the application, so I was sure something was wrong. I filled out the application. I had a resume already put together. I went up there and talked to the lady. But for my case, personally, I was on parole, and the parole officer told me I had to tell my employer that I had a background. So I thought, okay. I went up to the lady, handed her my resume, my application. She looked over, and she said, oh, this is perfect. We've been looking for upholsterers. And I said, well, it's not so perfect. I have to be honest with you. And I told her the story. She didn't even look up from the page. She said, hey, you guys got to work too. Sign the piece of paper. Bing, bang, boom. I'm working for this huge, huge company. I stayed with them for 8 years. When I left, they wanted me to move into a management position, mid-level management position. And I was in line for that raise. It was the place I wanted to be the whole time I was there. I'm making $26 an hour. They're doing this thing called 401k, which I'd never heard of. But, you know, as a former criminal, if you tell me I'll put in a dollar and you're going to put in a dollar, I mean, that's, I couldn't go wrong there. I said, yeah, I'm doing that. I don't even know what that means, but you're telling me if I put a dollar in the bank, you're going to put a dollar with it. I'm doing that game, whatever that is. And so the next thing I know, I'm making, like I said, making $26 an hour. I think I started at $8 an hour or something. God, just, it all started. I mean, you just start looking back. Like I said, it's that whole domino thing where I look back and realize how God had been moving all along. I thought I was just going down there to make 45 cents an hour in prison. He was training me for a job when I got out.
Yeah, and training you for what you're doing today, too. Jim, I could talk to you for a couple of hours. We have so much history, and there are so many vivid memories of my time there. But as I say, we've got about 15 minutes, and I want you to touch on the books that you've written. One you wrote already, one we're in the process of getting ready to publish. But talk to us about the books. Talk to us how you came to writing, and just talk to us a little bit about that journey, and then we'll talk a little bit about the content of the second book.
Well, as part of that discipleship class, the whole idea of writing a book and that sort of thing was already in the works, and we were already brainstorming those kind of things. At the end of the hallway at one of our one of our wings in prison, there's an empty room. And we used to sit in there and use that to brainstorm and pray and talk to each other. I sat down there one day, and everybody was talking around me, and immediately I got six or seven words that I threw on a page. It appeared to be an outline for a book. I thought that was the book. I thought that was a book. I'm going to write a book now. Here's the outline. Boom, 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 boom. It would be from one inmate to another. This is how that works. Little did I know that that was really an outline for my life, not an outline for a book, because God wanted me to learn to bear those things before I would share them. That's the way I look at it. I wasn't ready to write a book. I wouldn't have been writing from a position of strength at that time. I would have just been regurgitating words. But, man, over the next 6 or 7 years while I was in prison, and then even after I was released, I didn't write the book. I held that thing and worked on it in my heart, in my life. God worked in my life. And 10 years after I was released, I just couldn't hold it anymore. It was just built up inside of me, and I just felt the green light and put that book together monsters and butterflies, things that outline for my life. I was able to put it down in a book and talk to it from a position of strength, and a better platform for me to go back into the prison system and say, I don't think this is something that works. It's not something that I heard that works. I didn't pick this up in a sermon last weekend. I've been living this now for 10 years. The reason why I'm not back in prison with you guys again is because of these principles right here. So that was Monsters and Butterflies. Most recently, the book that we've been working on together is, I think, is called Growing Through Brokenness, A Struggler's Handbook. I think that's the title. That is a culmination of the last 10 years since I wrote that book. And it's been as a result of spending so many hours and years and days talking to people who are in transition, people who are in addiction, people who are in jails and prisons and dysfunction, who are struggling so hard, and equally as important, their families that have to deal with this and are trying to deal with this and not sure how to deal with this and making mistakes dealing with it, some of which have been fatal. Be quite honest with you, it's not a joke. It's, I just went to a funeral a couple of weeks back. It just, that's the downside of this job, if there is one, is that I learned to love these guys and treat them like my own sons, and God put that in my heart. That's another funny thing real quick, John, was that having gone to prison so early in my life at 30 years old, I had a daughter, but I never had a son. I always wanted a son. I always grieved to God about that, that I, you know, wished I would have had a son. I wish I would have, you know, done the right thing. And, man, he's given me 1,000 since then. Like, to the point that I want to go back to him and say, okay, we're good now.
But, paid in full.
Yeah. Maybe you got to be careful how you pray. But that's how it is. And I love these guys like my own sons. I can't help it. I want to help them not make the same mistakes I made. I want to help them not to hurt other people and not to hurt themselves and not to hurt their families and not to lose so many opportunities. And so that is the result of this book, John. It's just a whole bunch of conversations that I've had combined with a whole bunch of classes that I've taught over the years, criminal thinking, pre-employment, and those kind of things, and values and perspectives and those kind of things, and just kind of tried to put it all together in such a way that it wouldn't be overwhelming, and at the same time would have enough content to, you know, I can just put that out there and trust God to do the rest.
Yeah. You talk in this second book about the criminal addict thinking or mindset. Could you expand on that a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. So there seems to be, and it's certainly not my own original thinking, the criminal mindset comes from a couple of gentlemen who did a book called The Criminal Personality, Dr. Same Now. Very, anybody that goes to any type of criminal class in college or clinical criminality will read that book, and that's kind of the basis of it. So that's where I picked up on that term, the criminal addict, because it's kind of the same thing, addictive thinking, criminal thinking. There just seems to be a pattern that goes along with that. And it starts out early on with guys learning how to manipulate. We say the motto for the criminal addict, I put it on the board, we teach it routinely. Our motto is, I want what I want when I want it. That's just it. We learn that early on, and if it never gets parented out of us, we don't get taught a different way to cope with some of the things in our life or to get the legitimate needs that we have. I say that's what criminal thinking is. It's us trying to get our legitimate needs met through an illegitimate method. So we manipulate and we throw temper tantrums and we threaten and we use guilt and we just devise all these things. And as it turns out, there's a pattern, and it can be looked at, you know, in thousands of lives, and that's what happened with these guys who did this book, The Criminal Personality. So I use that as kind of a basis and then try to talk to them in our own language, and I say our language because I grew up like them. I grew up in their neighborhood. I grew up with that mindset. I understand it, and I try to just take those ideas and mirror them back so that they're able to look at it and say, that's who I am, first of all, and then let's find out what we can do different. That's the basis of the criminal thinking class.
Yeah. Do you, have you been doing this long enough that you have guys coming back to you who you've taught with feedback saying what a difference it made in their lives?
Absolutely. One of the guys that I met actually in the county jail, because I also go into the county jail and talk to guys at that level before they go to prison sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I met one of these guys there, tattoos all over, you know. James and I actually hand him a book. I would bring one book in the cell. I said, here, James, so when you read this book, and Monsters and Butterflies, and then pass it on to somebody else. Several months later, this same Jim, James, came walking through our program, the residential program. He spent 9 months with us there. He left there. Long story short, today, Jim is the head of men's recovery for Celebrate Recovery at a big church in Lakeland. He's a sponsor for our NA guys and just a great brother. He's done well now for 4 years. And this was a heroin addict with a long, long criminal history. Just one of many cases. Maybe not all of them as dramatic as Jim, but just watched. For me, to watch guys get back with their family and get their kids back and start doing the right thing, I know they don't have it all together yet. They're not perfect, but just to watch that thing grow, and that makes it worth worth it all.
Yeah. Again, we've got about 6 minutes or so. You mentioned the second book that we're working on is not just for the criminal addict, but those who are living with, dealing with, working with those who have that attitude. What do you tell them? What do you tell parents and spouses and others who you have a chance to talk to, who have somebody they really care about, who's entrapped in that thinking and consequently that lifestyle? What hope can you give them? What do you tell them?
Well, there absolutely is hope. The problem is that we start at the wrong place when we try to help someone. And I put that in parentheses, try to help somebody, is that we start too often with their habits. If he would just stop shooting heroin, if he just wouldn't drink as much, if he wasn't, if he would go to work every day. And it's at that level. And they try to spend money on that, throw money at it, or they end up so frustrated that they're angry and it turns into just some real bitterness, and you know, family members break apart. Sometimes husbands and wives will break up over a child who has an addiction issue or has a criminality issue. So the hope is that we take a step back and say, where we need to start out at is humility and gratefulness. That's where we have to get them. We have to get them to humility and gratefulness before they're teachable. You're trying to teach them something right now when they're not even, their heart's not even plowed yet. You can't put seed in that ground because it's not even plowed yet. And the way you do that is to go back and mirror some of those things and make them challenge some of those assumptions that they have. For example, I'll just use one real quick because I know we're running short of time, but
sure.
The whole idea of I love you. I love my family. It's not enough for you just to be able to say that. I mean, there's an actual definition to that. There's something that we can point at that says that's true or it's not true. And I think for me, that's been one of the most powerful aspects of this whole thing, this whole criminality and stuff that I teach these guys, is that if I can get them to see that love has certain characteristics, it cherishes, it honors, it gives, it's sacrificial.
Sacrifices.
It's not, absolutely. And it's not, you don't just get to say that. I mean, I understand there's a feeling involved in that, and you have a deep feeling for your family. But to say I love them has certain characteristics. And when you can point to those characteristics, it has the effect of causing some of these guys, not all of them, but some of them, to become humble in their thinking and grateful to the fact that when they realize, I really haven't loved my family. Hmm. Actually, it's been just the opposite. I've loved me and my addiction. And when you can get that switch to turn, when you can get them to see that for what it is, then we can start talking about teaching you some different things. Now the money you're spending and the conversations you're having start to make sense. I also talk about changing the conversation. We talk too much about the wrong things and not enough about the right things.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed reading that in your book as I've been going through the second one, the new one. I think it's great insight and it will be very helpful for people who are at their wit's end, you know, of and want to do anything they can for their loved one, but very often their instinct is causing them to do the wrong thing. And I always half jokingly tell people, you know, who want to know how they can get through to God, I said there are two things that I guarantee you, if you engage in, you will get God's attention almost immediately. And they said, well, prayer, worship. I said, nope. I said, you're either proud or you're humble. If you're proud or you're humble, it's like God, no matter how busy he is, stops what he's doing and comes to behold it one way or the other. He resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And those two attitudes are, you know, are, but even, you know, all joking aside, if somebody who is proud can admit they're proud, that's humility and God will help them. And I think that's the approach you're taking, that you have to get them to the place where they can be helped and that we can't want it more than they do. And they're going to have to set the stage for it to happen in their lives. Just a minute left. Do you enjoy writing, Jim?
I do. Absolutely do. Once I get started, like I can sit in front of a computer for hours sometimes, but once I get started, yeah, I absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's good, and you use good illustrations, and you've got a good flow, and it follows a logical progression, and and that monster's, you know, the monster's the butterflies. I bought that when I was on church staff and used to make sure our aftercare prison ministry had a supply of those that they could distribute among those that we were working, because I think it's just a wonderful work. Well, Jim, thank you for your time. Thank you for your life. Thank you for still being a part of mine, still listening to my ramblings, and as I go on and about what God knows, whatever. And I've got a pile of books here for you. I'm just waiting for one more of my titles that I just published, the Proverbs 31 Men. I want to send you some copies of those for your library. So you'll be hearing from me with another shipment. And I didn't do much on the book last week, but I'm going to get back to it this week, and it shouldn't be much longer, and I'll have an edited version for you.
I'm excited. Thank you, Brother John.
Well, you should be. My love to your family, to your wife. Happy New Year to you. Okay. Thanks again for your time, and I know we'll be talking soon. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Jim Adkins, who would have known? My life was so intimately connected to men who were in Tomoka Correctional Institution in Daytona Beach, Florida. God used them to release me, and I will always be grateful. And you heard the story of one of those men that I have gratitude for. Well, that's about it for today. John Stanker, your host, signing off again. Until we're back one more time, you be about the work of purpose in your life. Until then, so long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.